Good morning. So, last time we talked a bit about cases where forwarding wasn't enough to resolve some data hazards, and mentioned that typically what we'll do in that case is that we'll still use forwarding, but we'll combine it with stalling, which will give us something better than if we use just stalling alone, since we'll have to stall a lot less. We also looked at forwarding with different pipelines. So we're primarily interested in our textbook's five-stage design, but depending on what hardware components we have and what sort of performance trade-offs we're going for, we might want different pipeline designs. And those are going to have different effects on what hazards we have and whether or not we can resolve them with forwarding and how expensive they'll be resolved with stalling and so on. After looking at a bunch of data hazards, we started looking at our other big problem from our straightforward pipelining, which was what we called control hazards, where there are cases where we didn't know the correct PC value in time to fetch an instruction. And examples where this happened in YAD6 were our conditional jump, where we didn't know whether we wanted to go to the program counter that the jump target is, or just to the next instruction, ignoring the jump if it wasn't taken. And return, where we didn't know what the return address is that we'd read from the memory until we actually write it from the memory, which wouldn't happen soon enough in our pipeline for us to fetch the next instruction in the next cycle. And we mentioned that, well, for all these control hazards, we could use the solution of stalling, that when we don't know what instruction to fetch next, we can just stall until we do. For conditional jumps, we had another solution that was just basically just more efficient, which is often called branch prediction, that we're going to guess an outcome for the jump. The guess that we've been showing is that we guess that the jump is always taken, meaning it goes to the label in the instruction. Well, that guess isn't always going to be right, but that's okay. So when we figure out where the jump actually goes, at that point, if it matched our guess, we do nothing. And if it didn't match our guess, we need to correct that. So we need to squash the incorrect instructions, and just like we would have done without any branch prediction when we're just doing stalling, we fetch the correct next instruction. And we started talking about some mechanisms for implementing stalling and squashing when we finished up last time. But before I move on to talk more about that, questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
Will we have time to go over the last two questions of the quiz?
Well, I have time to go over the last two questions of the quiz. Let me remind myself what those questions were. So, quiz, last two questions were, okay, so on the quiz, the last two questions, we had an assembly snippet, and we had a six-stage processor, and it asked what happened for our cases where the jump was mispredicted. So the assembly, oh, right, this is going to be awkward to do. So we move that to screen one. So the So the assembly is, oh yep, I still don't have that in a good place. Okay, so the assembly is, oh right, here is that we have a push, an add, a JLE. And in this case, the JLE is not taken. So let's think about what's going to happen with our pipeline here. So but we're not advancing it. So we're going to have push is going to do fetch decode E1, E2, M. Add is going to do the same thing, but one cycle later. And the jump is going to do the fetch decode E1, E2. And we're going to predict it as taken. So we're going to fetch two instructions that we're going to squash eventually. That we're going to fetch them, but they're going to go away. And we can see, actually, in the example, that they're going to be an R remove queue and an I remove queue. But actually, we're going to fetch three instructions because the jump result happens at the E2 stage. So until the jump finishes the E2 stage, we're going to be fetching wrong instructions, which happen to be an I remove queue, an I remove queue, and an R. Sorry, R remove queue, I remove queue, R remove queue, if we look at the assembly from RR, IR, and RM move queue, if we look at the assembly. And then the XOR is going to be fetched, because that's the actual outcome of the jump. So when the XOR is fetched, the XOR is going to be reading the result of the add. The add's result is going to be written while the XOR is being fetched, which means when the XOR makes it to the decode stage, it's going to be in the register file, and it's going to read it from there. There's no forwarding needed. So that's question 5 on the quiz. So questions about that? Yeah. So question is, why are there three instructions? So we need to wait until the jump computes the outcome of the jump. And the question says the evaluation of the condition code is not available till the end of the XQ2 stage. And a reason why that would be the case is that if we think of how this works, we need to finish the add to know what those condition codes are. So if we had it during the E1 stage, we'd be saying we'd be evaluating the condition codes while the add is still being computed. Yes?
In this case, it's fine that the RR move queue in this case would get to the execute one stage before being squashed because nothing's looking back.
Question, in this case, it's fine that the R move queue would get to the execute one stage because nothing's written back? Yes. Presumably, the condition codes aren't modified, and that's the only thing we'd have to worry about. If that wasn't the case, we could still do branch prediction, and modern processors do. We just have to do some extra work to somehow restore the old condition codes, which, you know, would have extra logic for that, but that's very doable. Other questions? That doesn't look as ugly. Sorry, I was drawing with half of this as on my screen. Yeah. So the question is for question 4. So question 4, we have a processor which has a merged memory and write back. And it's asking why B is not selected. Why B is true. D is true. D is true. Did I make a... So it should be... memory with back. So that should be in decode. Execute. Memory and write back. No, I think that's an error in the key. Sorry. I will correct that key right now so I don't forget to correct that key. That's me counting incorrectly. Other questions? Yes. Question, isn't there a dependency that you have to stall for from the I remove queue to the first R remove queue? There is a dependency. You don't have to stall for it because we can resolve it with forwarding.
The I remove queue to the R remove queue.
Yes, the I remove queue to the R remove queue, we can resolve that with forwarding. Because we know the value 42 early enough, definitely. To the rmove queue, probably to decode from execute. We could also forward it later. But the important thing is that it's available, and it's available before we need it, very clearly. Other questions? Yeah.
Do you have time to go over question three on why you get one cycle slow?
So for question three, it's asking that on this four-stage processor, we have an mRemove queue followed by a subqueue. Why do we need one cycle of stalling?
Yeah,
so the result of the mRemove queue is not available to the memory and write-back stage. And that's going to be occurring while the subtract would normally want to do its execute stage. So it's not going to be available soon enough to start that execute stage with the value. So we have to stall. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
OK. Your question? Question three, which is asking about an mRemove queue followed by a subqueue. Sorry, I probably should be pulling up this question. Okay, other questions? Yes. So the question is, why don't we need to stall? So the situation is the same as in our five-stage processor. We're going to forward from execute to decode to resolve that. And there's nothing, the changes are all later in the pipeline, so we can still do that. Yeah.
So in question four, choice B, does the forwarding depend on the instruction in the forwarding map?
So question is, for question four or question B, we're mentioning, oh, we don't forward to IRMoveQ because IRMoveQ doesn't read R9. So does this mean that when you implement our forwarding boxes, that we're going to have some logic where we say, oh, if the I code is this, don't forward. So you could do that. Generally, it's easier to have the logic which checks the I code be in the computation of your destination register index. So we showed sort of passing around a dest E or a dest M about what register this instruction will eventually write to. Destination instruction, and the source register too, sorry. We compare that with the source register. So for IRMoveQ, my suggested solution would be to compute source B of IRMoveQ as register 9. And that way, when you check for forwarding, you'll say, oh, this doesn't use R9. And that's how I'd avoid doing that forwarding. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
For D, can you explain why that is? Because I feel like most of the class disagrees with it.
For D? That is incorrect. That will be corrected. That's a key error.
Okay.
Which. So, which we can make it fixed like so. Other questions? Yeah.
I'm sorry I came in like 5 minutes late. Did you go over one?
Did I go over one? No, I did not.
I was kind of confused by this because I didn't see how any of them had a data hazard when I drew it out.
So question is, why do these have data hazards? So the thing to remember about data hazards is that if we don't need stalling, it could still be a data hazard. If it's doing forwarding, then it's a data hazard because our original naive pipeline didn't work. So data hazard is, does the naive pipeline, before we do anything to deal with dependencies, work? Yes?
Are there dependencies and the hazard since the hardware has already resolved the hardware?
So the question is, do we still call the hazard if the hardware has resolved it? Yes. Back there. So the definition of a hazard is all about what the before resolutions naive pipeline would do. Like, what stuff do we need that extra logic for? Yes?
I kind of agreed with him, because just the wording of the question, because it said if executed on the processor described above, and it said that the processor used.
So the question is, like, so I guess the question is, why are we referring to a particular processor?
No, I just thought that the answer would be none of them because it said that it was using the processor.
Yes. So you thought it would be none of them because of the processor above. Yeah. So this was a question about the definition of a data hazard. Okay. So a data hazard is always about our naive pipeline.
Okay.
But we have to refer to a particular processor design because we need a particular way of choosing our pipeline stages. And maybe it's more obvious that it's still a data hazard if we were doing stalling instead of some less expensive way of resolving it, like forwarding. But forwarding wasn't a free way of resolving data hazards. It has some cost. It's just very cheap. Yes? So the question is, when we have conditional jumps, that's a control hazard? Yes. So the way to remember a control hazard is if we don't even know what instruction to fetch, it's a control hazard. Other questions? Okay, so let me get back. So, okay. So, and yes, and it's fine that we kick sound going over that because that traditionally causes people the most trouble on things like exams. So let's go over where we were last time. So last time we mentioned that we had these two muxes built into our register banks in HTLRS. We had one called stall that decides whether or not to send back the old value, meaning we keep the output of a pipeline register, usually, the same. If you were looking carefully at your HTL4 assignment, you may remember that you used this for the condition code registers to keep them the same versus not. And we had a bubble where we set the default value, and usually for pipeline registers, you'll set that to correspond to a no-op, so this will be how you insert a pipeline bubble and insert a no-op. And we went through this exercise showing how that works sort of mechanically. So now let's think about how that works with instructions. So I have arrows here corresponding to our pipeline registers. So I have fetch to decode to execute, execute to memory, memory to write back. I have the fetch to fetch is would be the PC. I have that marked with a star because we're going to talk some about doing some special things for that. And what I'm saying here is I have instruction A in write back, instruction B in memory, and so on. And in the next cycle, I want to end up with instruction B in memory, a NOP in execute, instruction C in execute, instruction a NOP, sorry, in decode, and fetch in E again. So how should I set my pipeline registers? My stall and bubble signals for my pipeline registers. And what we're looking for here is we're looking for stall bubble at time one. Why at time one? Because time one is when we set what happens at time two. So I'll give you a minute. what should they be for each of these registers? And so, for example, this here would be stall underscore, oh, that is not readable. That would be the D, because it's lowercase f, uppercase D. Yes. So the question is, how should I set my stall and bubble signals for these pipeline registers? Do I want to set it as a stall or bubble? We won't never do both, so that's not an option. Or do I want to leave them normal? Now I'll write these down as an S, N, or B, but S means stall register equals 1, B means bubble register equals 1, N means they're both 0. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with our fetch to decode. Who thinks that should be an S for stall? Think that should be an N for normal? Think that should be a B for bubble? Okay, so we have good consensus there. How about from decode to execute? Who think that should be an S for stall? Think that should be a B for bubble. Should that have to be N for normal? Okay, so we have seem to have got this pretty well. And so indeed, fetch to decode is B for bubble because we want the register to output a NOP in the next cycle. Decode to execute is an S for stall because normally we pass D from the instruction D from decode to execute, but we want to keep C, which is an execute there. So that's a stalling. From execute to memory, that's a bubble because we normally pass C, we want to NOP instead. And from memory to write back, that's normal because we want to pass instruction B, which would normally do that if we didn't. Questions? The question is, what do I mean by use by default? So the default I'm referring to is the one that would be written here in our register banks in HTLRS, which we're going to always make correspond to a no-op instruction, partly because we're going to use this to do things like squashing and inserting pipeline bubbles for a stall, and partly because when we're starting up our processor, we want to make sure that the write-back stage doesn't do anything until an instruction actually makes it there. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Could you explain why the stall D controls the first dash block?
So the question is, why does
the stall dash underscore D command controls the first bubble?
So the question is, why is the stall and bub, why is this big dash underscore D? So our signals in HTLRS are always named based on the output. So the output of that is the decode stage one, so it would be capital D if we name our registers the way the textbook does. And the two signals are stall and bubble. So in that case, we'd set stall D to 0 and bubble D to 1. Other questions? Okay, so I have a second exercise, but let's not use it because I think we're comfortable enough on this. And generally, if you want to figure out how do I do squashing, I recommend making a diagram like this and figuring out, okay, what should the signals be? So now that we sort of know how to do this with instructions, let's think of how we're going to implement stalling and prediction using these. So there's going to be two pieces. So one is the pipeline register. So we've kind of seen how to do that. So we look at what instructions do we want to go where, and we set the stall and bubble signals. Setting the PC, that's a bit more complicated. Now, I'll start with stalling. And I mentioned this idea of updating the pipeline registers, but something that people often miss is that just because it's stalling, doesn't mean that you only set a stall signal. So if we think of what happens with a stall, so in this case I have our load use hazard, and I'm saying that I'm going to be stalling in decode. So I'm going to fetch the subtract instruction, I'm going to get it to decode, I'm going to realize, wait a moment, this MR move queue doesn't have the value I want to forward available yet. So I need to stall, so I'm going to repeat that decode stage. So that's setting a stall signal. And because I'm repeating the subs decode stage, I'm going to have to fetch the IR move queue twice, because I fetched it before, but I realized, wait a moment, I can't advance this IR move queue yet, so I'm going to try again next cycle. Yes?
So would you only use bubbles when you're squashing?
The question is, would I only use bubbles when I'm squashing? And the answer is no, because in the process here, if I look at cycle 3, I need something in the execute stage. And that something is going to be a knob. And how am I going to put that knob there? With a bubble. Because if I don't put a bubble knob there, instead of having this knob, I'd have the same subtract instruction would get duplicated. And I can't do that. Like, I don't want two copies of this subtract instruction. Sorry?
Is the knot that you're inserting in cycle 2
the knot? The question is where I'm inserting the knot. So I'm inserting the knot starting in execute during cycle 3. And yet I would be inserting, I would be setting the bubble signal for it in cycle 2. So in cycle 2, to implement this, I'm going to need to do this stalling. So I'm going to set stall D and stall F to say, hey, the thing we have during cycle 2 in decode and fetch, I'm going to keep the same. Or, as we'll discuss later, for the fetch, we might do something different. I would recommend doing something with, instead of changing the pipeline register, just have a mux, just because you'll have some special cases that stall might not be the most intuitive way of dealing with. But I also need to make sure that the execute stage in cycle 3 has a no-op, so during cycle 2, I'm going to set a bubble for it. And I could have written this as one of those problems of during time 1, we have these instructions, during time 2, we have these instructions. I just needed to figure out that, in this case, during time 2, I had my IR move queue, my sub queue, my MR move queue, and presumably something in memory and write back. And during time 3, I had a knob in execute. That was an important thing to figure out, in addition to fetch and decode being the same. questions about this? Yes.
Yeah, so are we putting a knot in there because you have to stall for the subtract instruction?
Question, is the NOP ending in there because we have to stall for the subtract instruction? Yes, because the subtract instruction ordinarily would be here. But if we let it go there, then, you know, why do we stall it? Other questions? Okay, so that's our dealing with implementing stalling. So I think the textbook made a mistake in naming these signals, and they should not have called any of them stall, but they did, and will be consistent with the textbook. Because what we call stalling commonly is pausing an instruction in a stage and creating a pipeline block. So let's look at a mispredicted jump. That's our other case. So in this case, we don't have any pausing instructions in a stage, but when our jump makes it to the memory stage, we're going to deal with correcting the misprediction. So we will have fetched, and in one case decoded, two instructions that were mispredicted, and we need to turn them into NOPs. So we're going to do that by setting some bubble signals, and we also need to correct the next instruction, which we'll do with some logic on our PC, which I'll talk about a bit later. So this would be a case where we use that bubble signal as one way of doing this. We could also have some other mocks, but probably you want to use the bubble signal. So questions about this scenario? Yeah. The question is, why is the knob inserted from the execute stage for the XOR? And that's because the way our jump instruction works is we assume we figure out whether or not the jump is taken sometime in the middle of the execute stage. So the earliest we can possibly fetch the correct instruction is in the jump's memory stage. And while we're doing that, that also means that the earliest we can stop passing the XOR that we predicted through the pipeline is during the XOR's execute stage, because we'll have figured out to stop passing it through while it's in decode. Does that answer your question? So while the XOR is in decode, we figured out the outcome of the jump. That's the earliest we could say, don't pass this XOR further through the pipeline. The question is, why is the earliest time we can figure out the memory stage jump? So we figure it out in the execute stage. But in that point, the XOR is already decoded. So the earliest that the thing we got from the execute stage will take effect is, execute stage of the jump will take effect is in the jump's memory stage. Because remember that we're talking about what's in the pipeline register, so this is something which takes effect at the end of the previous cycle. Other questions? Okay. And another way we can look at that is, yeah, we can have a diagram where I show you sort of our signals and like most of the things we're passing instruction normally. Just when we discover this misprediction, after we, for a JNE, use the zero flag, we figure out, okay, next cycle we better fix some things, and we set those two bubble signals. And if we do this right, notably, the add queue doesn't make it to execute, so it doesn't change the condition codes. Yes.
So the bubbles are only inserted in cycle 5?
The question is, the bubbles are only inserted in cycle 5? Yeah. We set the signals for them in cycle 4, so they exist starting in cycle 5. And as for like how we would do this in HTLRS, so this means that we're going to have, you know, something where we like figure out, oh, did I just detect a mispredict for a jump instruction that's currently in execute? If so, I'm going to set bubble D and bubble E. There might also be some other cases where I set bubble D and bubble E, like for stalling for a load use hazard. Yes? Is it possible for a mispredicted instruction to ever get the execute stage? Not in our pipeline. Other questions? Okay, so there's one hazard I didn't talk about implementing the handling for as far as how it deals with pipeline registers, and that's return. So for return, we have to wait for the return to finish its memory stage before we can fetch the correct instruction. So while that's happening, we're going to have a bunch of stalling. And during that stalling, we're going to have to fetch something. It doesn't really matter what. So I have it marked as a bunch of question marks. Probably what you'll usually end up doing is fetching a return. But it doesn't really matter. The important thing is whatever we fetch, we're not going to use it because we're waiting for the return. So we're going to replace it with a nap when it goes from fetch to decode. We're not going to pass an actual instruction that, you know, does something from fetch to decode. So questions about this diagram I have here? So this is while we're waiting for the return to make it to memory, we're going to be fetching something because we have to fetch something. But we're going to ignore that and pass a pipeline bubble starting from fetch. Yes?
Why don't you just use stall instead of bubbling? Stall.
So why don't we use stall? So if we use stall, we'd be fetching return. And we pass another return down the pipeline. Or, yeah. And that's not going to be acceptable. Yes? Question is, why do I not have stages after F for the question mark instructions? Because we've replaced them with an up. So because we're setting the bubble D signal, they're never going to make it to decode. And that's what we want, because those question mark instructions, they aren't where the return actually goes. We haven't figured that out yet. So if they made it to decode and execute in memory, then they might be changing things, and they shouldn't. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, yes.
Handling return causes the instruction to be 3 cycles longer?
So the question is, are returns are 3 cycles longer? Yes, because we have to wait for the value to be read from memory that tells us where to jump to. Question is, are we updating the PC during those question mark instructions? It doesn't matter. All that matters is that the final result of the PC is updated at the end. Yeah?
How can you count 3 cycles when you're writing
HTLS? So the question is, how can we figure this out in HTLS? We'll get to that question. So first, let's look at an alternate view of this picture. So we're going to normally, we're passing things through the pipeline, but we'll just set the bubble for decode while the return is pending. And you have this good question of how do we figure out why while the return is pending? And what will often happen for figuring out the logic for these hazards generally is that we're going to say, well, the return is pending if it's in one of the later stages. How do we check if it's in the later stages? We can look at the pipeline register. So we want to set the bubble signal if there's a return in decode, or a return in execute, or a return in memory. So that's the condition I'm going to check for. Is the return currently in decode, or is it in execute, or is it in memory? If so, I want to bubble. Otherwise, I don't need to. So the way that look in HTTPS is we can read the I code from the pipeline registers. Yeah?
Can you explain one more time why we need to stall, or why we need to insert three bubbles?
The question is, why do we need to insert three bubbles? So basically, we can't do any work until our return makes it to memory, which is going to take 3 cycles. So we went to fetch here, which is what we end up doing down here. The problem is that the other stages of the pipeline, they need work. If we don't do anything, they're going to find some work. So we need to make sure the work we give them is norms. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is, what is the difference between this and stalling? This is stalling. So it happens that we have, this is stalling, it's just, it happens that we implement it by inserting pipeline bubbles, and since we, you know, we're stalling basically a mystery instruction, we don't have anything to keep in fetch specifically. Does that explain things? So this I would call stalling. We're stalling the rmove queue instruction, but we can't even fetch it yet, so we're stalling a placeholder. We're keeping a placeholder in fetch and passing a pipeline bubble while it's waiting. So this is an implementation of stalling, just a weird case because it's a control hazard. Yes?
So what would be fetched if we hadn't inserted the three bubbles?
Question is, what would be fetched if we hadn't inserted these three bubbles? So who knows? It's whatever the default case of your MUX is, I guess. Yeah? What's in the question mark? It's the same thing that she asked. What would be fetched if we didn't do anything? And I have it as question marks because it shouldn't matter. Right? We're going to have some value in the paragraph counter, but it shouldn't matter because we're going to replace it with something else before that any instruction makes it to decode. And my recommendation for implementing this would be to keep the return address in there, but there are other options. It doesn't really matter what you do, as long as you get the logic of after the return makes it down the pipeline that you fetch the correct thing. Does that answer your question? So, other questions? Okay, so that's our return. Okay, so we talked about implementing the pipeline bubbles we need and the squashing we need that's related to that. Let's talk about our PC update. And I'm going to talk about building it the kind of way our textbook does. This might not be the way I would have made it. So I'm going to build this by just going through all our cases for all the ways we'd update our PC. So our normal case is we have our PC plus our instruction line. So you've implemented this a bunch of times. We also have a case where we take an immediate value. So this is for call and jump. We have a value from the instruction. And this is also going to be our prediction for conditional jumps. So since we're choosing the predict always taken, it's the same thing as for our normal call or an unconditional jump. We also have some cases where we want to repeat the previous CV. Oh, sorry. I should mention something I'm doing here is I'm renaming our PC to our predictive PC. This is matching what our textbook does. And the reason I'm doing that is that later on, I'm going to have to do something about my predicted conditional jumps, which I'm not showing yet. This is not the quote-unquote real PC. It's our prediction. So our third case is that we have stalls, like our load use hazard, also halt, where we probably want to repeat the previous program counter. We don't want to fetch new instructions, so we repeat the previous PC. Okay. And you could use the stall signal that's built into register banks for this, which is valid and probably what you've done in PipeLab 1. I find it easier to just make my separate box for this case because of all the other cases kind of interacting with it, and I want to make sure I understand how that's going. So we have our fourth case, which is that we need to sometimes correct the misprediction for the conditional jump. And I could have added this to the mux that's before that register, and I could add it after. Adding it after is what our textbook does, so that's why I'm drawing this on our diagram. Note that if I'm doing this, this is from what stage of the conditional jump? So where are we going to get that value? So we remember our diagram. We have a conditional jump, and we fetch the corrected instruction on a misprediction when the conditional jump makes it to memory. So with this picture, this would be from the memory stage of that conditional jump. That's where that next PC would be stashed. You might say, how are we going to keep track of that? And what our textbook recommends, what I think makes sense, is that we're going to pass it in the pipeline registers the same kind of way we pass the iCook. Yes?
For prediction for conditional jumps, we put the address of, we put the new PC right from the fetch stage, right? Like right back at the fetch stage for the prediction. If you predict that, like, we're going to take the jump.
So the question is for prediction for conditional jump, for a normal prediction, for a correct prediction? So the correct predictions are handled using this immediate value. So the way a correct prediction works is that we do the same thing we do if it were an unconditional jump. Does that answer your question? So this other signal that I'm highlighting now is only for when that prediction was wrong. How do we fix it a couple cycles later? Other questions? Yeah. The question is, why is it after the memory stage? Because this mux is after our PC register, we want to be fetching based on what's on that wire right now. So if instead this signal went to here, then we do it during the execute stage. Because we're preparing for the next cycle, but here we're deciding what to do for this cycle. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Like, are we adding an extra fetch state, or are we just like checking the program counter like during the?
So the question is, are we adding an extra fetch state here? No. So all this logic here. This is part of the fetch stage and includes our instruction memory. It's all one stage. There's not going to be any pipeline registers after this PC until the decode stage. This, I guess, predicted PC until the decode stage. Yes?
So are we calculating what the next instruction would be if the jump isn't correct?
So question is, are we calculating what the next instruction would be if the jump isn't correct? That is something we're going to need to do. And that's something we're going to be doing in the jump's fetch stage. Because that's going to be, when we fetch the jump, that's going to be on this wire here. So we don't actually need to do an extra calculation. What we need to do is we need to take the value on this wire and send it through pipeline registers for later. Yes. The question is, if we're predicting that the conditional jump won't happen, just getting the next instruction? No. So our prediction, our normal case for a jump, is that we use this signal after we fetch the jump to prepare for the next cycle. Sometimes that will cause us to do something wrong. One of the things we will have done to correct that being wrong is we will have done this squashing, where we set some bubble signals. But the other part we have to do is we have to fetch the correct thing. So the logic our textbook proposes for fetching the correct thing is that we're going to have a mux just before the instruction memory, after the program counter, the predicted PC register, that puts in the correct value instead of the thing we normally fetch that's from our prediction. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and so the immediate value in the JSX be available like in decode?
The question is the immediate value available in decode? So note that the things before this predicted PC register are happening during the fetch stage of the previous instruction. So when we're fetching the jump, all the logic I've highlighted is happening while that jump's being fetched. Because it's going into a pipeline register, it's not going to take effect until the decode stage of the jump, which will be the fetch stage of the next instruction. Yes?
Is the stalling PCY not explicitly written in the code because they're using the stall app?
The question is, the stalling PCY not explicitly written in the code? If you use the stall app, it will not be explicitly written. You do not have to use that. I prefer not to use it, just because I want it to be really clear to me what cases am I stalling versus one of these other options. Does that answer your question? So I prefer to have clarity about whether what priority stalling has over other options for the PC. So I prefer to write that wire explicitly just for the PC, but if you don't do that, it's going to be implicit, like you said. Okay, other questions? Okay, and we have one more option, which is the return address from jump. Our textbook decides to fetch this from the jump's write-back stage and have it replace that dummy value we were passing to the fetch stage while the jump was waiting to complete its memory access. So this is how our textbook proposes handling the PC update. So I'm showing you this to match the textbook because that's also what we have as our primary explanation in the HCL 8 assignment, and because it matches our textbook. This is probably not what I would have done. I probably would have had one mux before the PC register, but this also works. I think our textbook wanted to emphasize that we're predicting a PC and emphasize that it's a prediction. That's why they organize things this way. But I would have preferred to just have one mux, which would also work, but things would have to come from different stages. Some questions about our overall PC updates? Yes? What I mean by missing return address. So remember when a return was happening, we didn't know what to fetch yet because we missed the return address. So that's the wire that's getting us the actual return address so we can fetch while the return makes it to the write-back stage.
So what's missing?
What's missing is that we didn't know what instruction to fetch. We didn't know the program counter of the return. You know the program counter the return would go to. Other questions? Yeah.
So does forwarding for that work? Because when you insert a bubble, like memory will still be after the same thing.
The question is, does forwarding for that work? Because when we insert a bubble, memory will be the same thing. So if you notice this diagram, I say we're going to get that return address from the memory to write back registers. So our return instruction at that point is going to be in the write-back stage when we want to fetch. So we're going to get it from, the blue dot there, dotted line. We're going to get it from that memory to write-back registers and send it to the fetch stage. So there's no forwarding works because it is actually the return instruction. It's not a bubble or anything like that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so that's our processor. And we've talked about our sort of overall stalling after we're all done. So we have load use hazards we mentioned, and we have return. Those are the cases where we need to stall. Like to remind people, because it comes up sometimes in the assignment, that I showed you a load use hazard with an hour remove queue, but pop also reads from memory and also can have load use hazards. And so overall, we end up with a processor where we have most hazards solved by forwarding, we have one cycle of stalling for load use hazards, and we have a two cycle, what was often called a branch delay or branch penalty for a misprediction. And we do squashing, and we have a three cycle penalty for returns. So that's, I'm gonna finish. So questions on our CPU? Yes. So the question, if the execute stage were split into three stages, would it be a four-cycle penalty for misprediction? Yes. Assuming we can't somehow shortcut getting the condition codes. Which, at that point, you might consider it. Other questions? Yeah.
Sorry, what is a load use hazard?
What is a load use hazard? That is reading something from memory and then you trying to use it in what would be the next cycle. Or what would be the same cycle, but in the next instruction. So like our M remove queue followed by add example. Okay, so that's our processor. So let's move on to our next topic, and that's gonna be looking at our memory. So our model was that we took one cycle for instruction, and that included two memories. And when I introduced memories, I said, oh, the memory's on a different chip. We definitely can't talk to the different chip in one cycle if we want our cycle time to be anything reasonable. And we mentioned our solution was keeping copies of parts of memory, known as cache. That'd be fast. And we're going to use actually a lot of space for cache. So here's a 2004 CPU. Why 2004? Because I could. Because first of all, it's a single core, so that's a little easier to show. And secondly, because someone figured out where all the parts of the core were, which is not always done for a more modern processor. So on this 2004 CPU, here are the registers. That's that red box. That's where the registers are. So this processor has floating point and integer registers, so there's a floating point unit with floating point registers, and the normal execution units with integer registers mixed in with them. Okay, so storage for that. And then we have the level one cache. So there's a cache for data, so which is basically what our data memory is. And there's a cache for instructions, which is basically what our instruction memory is. Then there's this periodic structure over here. That's a level two cache. And you'll notice that it takes up more than half of the processor. And this is typical. And this has gotten probably more extreme on modern processors, where we'll have some sort of shared cache for multiple cores that takes up most of the chip. And these form what we call a memory hierarchy. So registers are smallest and fastest. And the L1 cache is next smallest and next fastest. And the L2 cache, next so. And on a modern processor, we most commonly for a desktop or a laptop processor, you'll also have an L3 cache. And then we have main memory. So as we go down this hierarchy, things get bigger as far as storage and physical size. and they get slower. So, sort of, these are modern times, not 2004 times. So, registers, we can typically access in about 1 cycle. So that's going to be, you know, less than a nanosecond. L1 cache is about a nanosecond. So, you know, if you think of like a 3 gigahertz processor, like 3-ish cycles. L2 cache is about 5-ish nanoseconds. L3 is about 20. And I say ish because like this can be like a factor of 2 or 3 range. And main memory is 100-ish nanoseconds. The question, are these numbers how long it takes to do like 1 clock cycle, or what does it mean? So these numbers are latency numbers. So they are not throughput numbers. Throughput numbers are a little better, which is helpful because we want to fetch 1 instruction each cycle. If each fetch took 1 nanosecond from the L1 cache, that wouldn't be very good. If our cycle time is less than that. But these are latency numbers. Yes? So the question is, why are there 2 parts of registers? So one of them is floating point registers, and one of them is general purpose integer registers. So this is an x86-64 chip here, or maybe 32. It's an x86 chip. And x86 traditionally has separate registers for floating point. This is a very common decision, actually, in instruction sets to make the floating point instructions use a separate set of registers. Question. So all the registers we've dealt with are integer registers? Yes. Other questions? Okay. And you can see that from a point of view of what's worth spending hardware on, cache is extremely important. That we're willing to invest a lot of chip space, in fact, way, way more chip space for cache than we devote to like the ALU. So like, for example, like our whole floating point unit, like the stuff that does floating point multiplication and division, which is not simple, in addition, also really not simple, is substantially smaller than our caches, it's like about the size, maybe about the size of our L1 caches. And that's very typical. So another thing that we'll allude to later is that you may also notice that we're spending a pretty lot of space on logic to deal with doing loads and stores, on fetch and decode related logic. And part of the fetch and decode related logic is that this processor, like many modern processors, devotes a lot of space to branch prediction. So many of these periodic structures here are for branch prediction. So rather than predicting all jumps as taken, this processor does something a lot more complicated, which involves tables that it has to store on the chip. Okay. But we have these caches. So let's think about how these caches work. So this cache is like our data memory or our instruction memory. So it takes in an address, it takes in an input if we're writing, and a write-enable signal, and puts out a value. But it doesn't take a fixed amount of time. So rather than being a one-cycle thing, one way this could work in hardware is that it could have a ready signal. And when the value's in the cache, we're going to get ready yes. When it's not, we're going to have to go to the next level of cache or main memory. And our model is going to be that the cache is responsible for communicating with the next level, whether it's, you know, L1 to L2, or eventually like L3 to main memory. So our processor is going to ask the cache, hey, give me this memory value. And if the cache doesn't have it, it's going to get it. And that's going to take a while. So it's going to not set this ready signal to true until it's done. And in that case, well, our instruction is going to have to start. Okay, questions about this model? Yes. So the question is, how is the cache organized? Is it something like a register file, or? So, oh, question, is this memory like a register file? So this is, so except for the ready signal, this is the same interface our data memory has that we're using in HCLRS. The only difference is the addition of this ready signal from the point of view of the processor. That's accessing memory. Yes?
So the input would just be whatever you're writing to the memory address specified above?
The question is, the input value is the whatever we're writing to the memory address specified above? Yes. Yeah.
Is there no read enable?
Is there no read enable? So there probably would be a read enable, I just didn't draw it. Yes. The question is, would the ready output come into play if you're just writing to a memory address? Yes. We are going to have to wait for the write to finish too, at least to finish enough that the cache doesn't need us to keep having the value to write ready. So a reason why this would be is that this latency number here that I showed you is also going to be an issue for writes. So if we have to write too much stuff, we'll might exceed the capacity of the cache to do that writes or the main memory to do that writes, and we'll have to stop somewhere. So it's going to couple in writes that, you know, we can only do so many writes, so we're going to need to have the processor slow down if we're doing too many. Does that answer your question? Okay. So our cache is basically going to sit between the CPU and actual memory, and hopefully, you know, most of the time, the cache can satisfy the reads or writes, but when it can't, it's going to go to the next level. And when it does that, it's going to forward the result, and also, it's hopefully going to remember it for later. So if after this exchange, after I ask for ABCD once, hopefully if I ask for it later, the cache will remember it. But the cache has limited capacity, so that won't always happen. And our overall goal with doing this is that we're going to hope that the cache doesn't need to go to the next level often enough that we'll get the performance of that small, fast memory. That most of the time, we'll do that. So if we want to hide 100x difference in latency, we want to have like a 99% what we'll call a hit rate. That's the rate at which values are found in the cache. But we want to give the capacity of the slowest memory. And you might say, this doesn't sound possible, and in general, it's not. But there's two things which are going to let us get very, very close in practice. That we're going to give our program something very close to the performance of that small cache and the full capacity, and that's because of two assumptions we're going to make about how programs work. If these aren't true, we're not going to be able to succeed. And those two assumptions are going to be temporal locality and spatial locality. So our temporal locality assumption is that if we access a value now, we'll access it again soon. And to take advantage of this, our cache should keep values that were recently accessed. And our spatial locality assumption is that if a value is accessed now, adjacent values, like values that are next to it in an array, will be accessed again soon. To take advantage of this, caches should store not just one value in isolation, but should store the values around it in memory, so adjacent memory addresses. And these two properties, these two assumptions I'm making, they clearly aren't always true, but if I take a random program, usually they'll be the case. And to illustrate why, let's look at a loop. So here's a compute mean function, and this function has many examples of great temporal and spatial locality. So we have great temporal locality in the machine code for the loop. So if we fetch the instructions that make up that total plus equals values of I once, we're going to fetch it many, many times again. We have great temporal locality. So as long as our cache keeps those recently accessed instructions in there, we're going to have a very high hit rate when running this loop in our instruction cache, which corresponds to our instruction memory. We have great spatial locality. If I access the instruction that sets total equals zero, it's really likely I'm going to access the instruction that's after it in memory, which is probably the start of the loop. So if my cache decides to not just load one instruction, but load all the adjacent instructions, it will have a very high hit rate because of that. I also have good temporal and spatial locality in my data. So if I'm storing total I or length in memory, those are going to have great temporal locality. I'm accessing them over and over again. And I'm only accessing the values in the array once, but I always access values I plus 1 after values I, so if I'm fetching them in big chunks into my cache, I have great hit rate. There's good spatial locality, and I can take advantage of that to get a very high hit rate. And notice that I didn't do anything contrived to have good temporal and spatial locality. This is just something which happens. And indeed, I could have written a program which had horrible temporal and spatial locality, but these are not the programs that people write. And because of this, this is why our caches can have actually good performance. So questions about temporal and spatial locality? Yeah?
So were caches created because we write programs this way, or do we write programs this way?
Question, were caches created because we write programs this way, or do we write programs this way because of caches? I would say caches are created because we write programs this way. It's just really hard to think of any natural way of organizing code where you don't have these properties. Yeah.
How are we taking advantage of this? Are we speeding up this clock cycle on the fly?
So questions, how are we taking advantage of these? So let's go back to our definition. So temporal locality, if I'm accessing a value now, I will be accessed again soon. So from the cache's perspective, if you see me access value X, what do I want to do? I want to make sure I keep X in my cache at least for the next little while. And importantly, if I have to choose between keeping X and Y in the cache, and I know X is accessed sooner, probably want to keep X. So this is going to help us design our caches. For spatial locality, if you access array of 1 or machine code at address 52, maybe I should also fetch address 55, 56, 57, because you're likely to access that soon. So I can just get larger chunks of values to take advantage of spatial locality. Yes? When are things from L1 cache pushed to L2 cache? We will get to that later. The answer is it depends. There are a couple different good ways of implementing it depending on some trade-offs you want to make as far as, you know, performance and also synchronization with other cores and things like that. So we'll talk about basically three-ish different options for that. Other questions? Okay. So I think that's where I will leave off today. So next time we will talk about, given that I have some data, how do I make a cache, you know, of a certain size? Let's talk about the simplest way of doing that.